The April Parade of Poets continues on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we meet Lucas Street, director of Augustana's Writing Center, who is also a poet, on Scribble.
Lucas, I have heard about you from Ann Bowden, and I know your name and that you are a very good poet. But who is Lucas Street? Let's start out by giving just a brief background.
Sure. So Lucas Street is, as you said, director of the Reading Writing Center at Augustana College. He has an MFA in poetry from University of Wyoming. He writes, publishes, and performs poetry. He is also a husband of one and father of four. He also occasionally gives biography in the third person.
That's very good. I was going to ask if you've ever met him.
Occasionally.
Poetry at the University of Wyoming. That has the smallest art council of all the states, I think.
It's a very, shall we say, not populous state. So the total population of Wyoming is about the same as the population of the greater Quad City area.
Uh-huh. So why Wyoming?
Mountains.
Okay.
Growing up in the Midwest all my life, my wife, the same, grew up in the Midwest. I was applying to grad school, and so we applied anywhere but in the Midwest and ended up in Wyoming and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, that is an interesting state. A person who used to be here at the station was director of the Arts Council out there for about 8 years.
Okay.
Joy Thompson. Yes, that's and I hear a lot from her about Wyoming. But poetry, what steered you toward poetry?
I'd been writing since I was a boy and into adolescence, as many do, and then actually went back to school to complete my undergrad after getting married, starting a family, and was attracted to the creative writing program at Knox in Galesburg. And that was when poetry really took off for me, and taking some of the poetry writing courses, some excellent faculty there, and really starting to read contemporary poetry in a way that I really hadn't in the past. It really sort of sucked me in, and I haven't escaped since.
I remember Dave Barry writing a column about poets are the best paid people in the country. Most of them have private airplanes and so on.
Right.
He obviously has a taste for bizarre humor.
Well, let me ask one more general question, and then we'd like to hear you read a poem or two and then talk a little bit about Poetry Month.
Sure.
Is poetry for you a vacation or a vocation?
Is it a calling,
or is it a relaxation?
That's a great question. I would say vocation. I think poetry is hard. Poetry is hard work, and much of the time I would rather be doing something else, like reading a novel.
You force yourself to sit down and do it?
I force myself to sit down and do it, and after I've done it, it feels good, you know, like taking a brisk walk or some other sort of exercise.
Now, I identify with this gentleman because I hate to write myself.
I hate beginning. I have spent more time on the first sentence of an essay or something that I'm writing. You know, once I get the first sentence, the second sentence kind of is determined by the first sentence.
For me, whatever I can think of as a first sentence determines what I'm going to write about.
You know, it sounds to me, Lucas, like vocation can even be stretched further to calling.
Yeah, I would say so. I can see that as it's something that's, you know, very meaningful to me, and I do see it as a way to kind of engage with truth, whatever that is and a way to kind of engage with other people through those words.
It reminds me of Carl Jung, the psychologist who believed in the collective unconscious, who said it was not Goethe who wrote Faust, but Faust who wrote Goethe. Mm-hmm. That is, something. Mm-hmm. If you're called, something is calling, right? And it's that force from the outside.
Yes, but you do have to earn a living. And so the
not by poetry. No. One does not earn a living.
That was my point. So you're a director of the Writing Center.
Yes.
And what does that entail?
That entails a lot of talk about writing. So sitting with students and working with them to try to help them present the best possible version of themselves through writing. It entails teaching a few classes. And also just sort of the nuts and bolts, the administrative work behind the scenes and all that comes with being a faculty member at Augustana.
What's interesting is the Writing Center is now at the Gerber Center, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah, it is.
And that is the real change from going from Old Main to the Gerber Center, which is kind of like a busy thoroughfare.
Yeah, it's sort of the student center now. So we have the cafeteria just one floor above us and you know, still houses the library. So, but we have moved to more of kind of a center space for campus.
I was in on the beginning of the Writing Center back in the 70s.
Yes.
When it was in Old Main. And that was innovative then because if you went to a Writing Center at most colleges, they were back of the boiler room where the janitor held out because colleges were ashamed of having to have a writing center.
Yeah.
And well, look how this has changed.
Yeah.
It's changed a lot, and we have a lot of institutional support, and we're very blessed to have that kind of that support from
But your
from
poetry.
Up the ranks.
We want to hear some of your poetry.
Sure. I would love to read some of my poetry. So so I already told you that I spent a couple years in Wyoming, and so friends in Wyoming would tell us that in Wyoming there's really only three seasons instead of four. There's winter. There's July and there's August. So winter, you know, stretches long. And I thought since we're in the – hopefully coming to the end of a similarly long winter here in the Quad Cities, I thought I'd read sort of a poem about a Wyoming winter. The kingdom of heaven is like high-altitude weather, patches of warmth punctuated by snowfall. You might be enjoying a backyard picnic and notice flakes dissolving in your lemonade. Or you're holding the head of a snowman but can't find its body. You check the forecast faithfully, yet find only false prophecies. Come June, nights quit freezing, time at last to plant. You search flea markets for colanders from which to make makeshift pots but find none. Anyway, it hails all afternoon. You settle for digging in the sand with a plastic shovel, carefully planting and watering twigs, rushing inside when storm clouds gather. Meanwhile, everyone speaks of how sublime the summer will be, hoping to ease your unspoken doubts.
Well, as a matter of fact, what is that in the southeastern corner of Wyoming? Is the hail capital of the world.
Yeah, that's where we were, right there in Laramie. Yeah, yeah, hail without warning.
But so you draw from what you experience for your poems, huh?
Somewhat, yeah. There's always some piece of that, but I tend to approach my poems a little more like fiction, where it starts or the idea begins with something out of experience, but then takes a hard left turn and goes places I've never been.
So do you have a particular time of day when you sit down and say, I'm, you know, like punching a time clock?
I don't. I think that would be wise. I think it's, as a father of young children, I think it's whenever the kids are asleep. And so when the baby's down for his afternoon nap, sometimes if I'm at home, sometimes can be a good time. But I just try to steal, you know, 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there.
So take us through how a poem begins for you. And your kids are asleep, you know, it's 8 o'clock and you've sat down. What happens?
Yeah, well, a couple of different ways. So often it'll begin with just some kind of free writing. Just, you know, I'll have a phrase or an idea that I'll just kind of write that down and see where that takes me without, you know, thinking too hard about it. And then I have a lot of rough material that I can go back and take a chisel to. Sometimes I'll start with a very specific idea. I write for the last several years, I've been writing in parable form. So I write a lot of parable poems, in which case I might start with a more formed idea, like I want to compare this to that. And then I sort of develop and extend that idea. So a couple of different ways.
Have you published your poems?
Just in some online journals. I have a manuscript, a full-length manuscript that I'm shopping around, but no luck yet.
Well, you know, poetry is hard to sell to publishers. It really is.
It's true.
There are a few poets who, for some reason or other, have established a big enough reputation that you can publish 500 of their books, and there's a good chance they will be sold.
Right.
So what keeps you writing poetry if there's not the promise of publication?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think back to what Roald said about the vocation. I feel compelled to do it. And it would be nice if people read it and took something from it. But I feel like I'm just kind of compelled to write these things and to bear witness to things. And so it's just the work I do.
So when you write a poem, is your mind on the witness to the thing? Or is it on a – do you imagine an audience that you're writing for? Or are you writing to sort of figure out what you mean?
I think it's both. I think the poem has a mind of its own, but on the other hand, sometimes, as I said, sometimes I'll have an idea that I want to flesh out, a way of kind of telling the truth, but telling it slant, right? Which I guess is the task of probably all poetry, but I particularly like that idea of trying to say something that's true and that resonates, but in a way that you come around to it in the way that parables do, and you kind of your audience sort of lets down their guard. For something that they may not have been wanting or ready to hear otherwise.
Do you have another poem you could read for us?
I do, yeah. So I'll read a poem since, we are coming into spring. That makes me think about camping. It's something we love to do. So I'll read a poem about a camping trip that's gone awry, one of those left-hand turns that I mentioned. When you, mentor, broached this camping trip, I thought you meant someplace mountainous, Medicine Bow or Vita Vu, but you packed a shopping cart full of supplies and pushed it a mere 3 miles to Black Hawk Park. That red plastic carriage, the hiking path, deciduous, ambling and aiming to do what few had done before. For sustenance, your 60 hard-boiled eggs will only last a week, and then it's foraged violet petals, dandelion greens, sumac tea steeped in a camp stove pot. You said, I will sling myself between two trees, which I hope aren't too far apart. My own cart has a bad wheel and only goes in circles, so I stay behind, cleaning and buffing the plastic frame, oiling the wheel works till they glisten, tinker with the crooked one I can't ever get straight.
I love the way you play with sounds in that. And in fact, both of these poems, they should be published somewhere.
You know, you brought up something. Sometimes I think of a phrase, and that will start me writing. I was thinking about failing memory. And the idea of deciduous dendrites from which fall your memories. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I can't let go of this, but I can't make a poem out of it. So I wrote some kind of essay, which I filed because it has no earthly use at all. But do things like that spur you on to poetry?
The sounds in particular, the mm-hmm. sounds of words? Yeah, absolutely. That's one of my favorite things about poetry is just playing with sound and just seeing how sounds fit together and how you can create patterns or frustrate patterns even in, you know, a free verse situation.
Well, I find it frustrating to come up with something like that and not know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's the poem itself, Don. Maybe just that phrase is the poem.
Well, talk a little bit about how you go about revision. I was just reading a mm-hmm. Mary Oliver essay in which she said, after 40 or 50 versions, something begins to emerge that may seem to have a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sort of endless revision. And in some cases, you know, I've tried to write the same poem for a couple years and just, you know, couldn't get it right, put it away, try it again.
How do you know it's not right?
It just doesn't. It doesn't feel complete. It doesn't interest me, you know. It doesn't say what I want it to say. So that's an extreme example. For me, it's more often, you know, I get that chunk of content through just kind of open free writing, and then I just start taking things away. I cut things out, take out a lot of the connective tissue, a lot of the throat clearing, just strike that out and just try to keep the most resonant phrases and then play around with, of course, rearranging. And one thing I don't do anymore is lineate my poems. I write pretty much exclusively prose poetry because I found that when I was writing a standard poem with lines, I would fixate on those line breaks to the point where that would be all the revision I'd be doing is just playing, oh, what if I break the line here? And what if I jam the line there? And so I found that that was kind of preventing me from getting deep into my content in a way that I should have been. So I chose to just do away with lines, and I haven't gone back since.
I notice your poems are square on the page.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you persistent? If you're working at something and it's not going well, do you just abandon it, or do you keep going until, by golly, I get this right?
No, I think I abandon a lot more than I persist in. Yeah, yeah, there are a lot of and occasionally I'll go back to something abandoned and I'll find a fragment, you know, that I can repurpose later. But no, if something's not working, I'll just toss it out.
How much time a week do you think you spend on poetry, if you average it out?
On writing poetry, as far as putting pen to page, not very much these days. I would say maybe an hour. Often I'm thinking about a poem or reading a poem, you know.
Yeah, how much was in your head, though?
Mm-hmm, It's hard to quantify, yeah, but there's a lot that goes on in the head.
What sparks a thought in your head that could lead to poetry?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, I think it's happening all the time, and sometimes.
What began that poem you just read?
The camping trip. Oh, that was a.
I mean, there's so many neat details in there. Any one of which could have.
Yeah, some of that comes from experience. It's a lot of details from life, from conversations I've had, or from things I remember. But in that case, it's part of my larger project, and so I wanted to write something about a specific character in the project. Again, the language of fiction, right? Characters. I wanted to write something about a specific character and then kind of, you know, why that character was no longer present in the narrative and kind of merge that with some of my own memories and just kind of threw it all together and mixed.
Do you teach when you're at the writing center, mm-hmm. do you teach prose or poetry?
When I'm in one-on-one conferences with students, it's usually essays, actually. Yeah, they bring me their essays, papers for classes, or sometimes, you know, professional documents, like a personal statement. And I'll help them kind of revise and edit those. When I'm teaching my classes, I teach mostly nonfiction, mostly essay, but I do sneak in poetry here and there, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could use your classes. I must say, you lead an interesting life, Lucas Street. And you're at the Gerber Center, at the Writing Center at mm-hmm. Augustana College.
That's right.
Thank you very much for visiting with us, and keep thinking and writing about poetry.
Thank you so much.
And on to the book bag after a visit with our poet today, Lucas Street.
That was a good visit.
Yes, he's a very pleasant and animated young man.
Well, plus, I thought that poetry was absolutely terrific.
It's interesting that his poems were in squares.
Well, it's prose poems, and that's become a fairly popular form, I think.
Uh-huh. The shape of them was...
Well, it's getting increasingly difficult to tell the difference between prose and poetry, and I think that's a distinction that used to be very important, right?
Well, how do you tell the difference?
I use Emily Dickinson's thing. You read and it blows the top of your head off. It's a poem, right?
Yeah, but I read some... I read some books. Let me give you, for instance, I think I have it here somewhere. There's a person who's written a book about a very difficult subject. It's about the, and I'll talk about it later on, it's about evolution and whether evolution is entirely accidental or whether there it's kind of purposeful, that it's converging. And there's one sentence in there that I thought, what is this doing in a nonfiction book? Crete didn't have a monopoly on puny pachyderms. Indeed, tiny tuskers involved on many islands. Three lessons can be drawn from this profusion of paltry proboscideans. What? What's that doing in the middle of a nonfiction book? So maybe poetry erupts everywhere. I don't know. But the distinction between prose and poetry, I think, becomes rather difficult.
Well, I think, Lucas would say that's not as important as it once was.
Uh-huh.
That would be my guess.
Okay. Well, my guess is that there may be something in the book bag today.
Well, I have a couple of books, and I'm going to anthologies of poetry that I'm going to talk about since it's Poetry Month. The first one, and that's all I'll have time for today, is by a person who is a senior editor at W.W. Norton and Company. She's also a poet herself who's written in The New Yorker and Atlantic and other places like that. But she has just come out with a book called Poetry Will Save Your Life. Her name is Jill Bialoski, Bialoski. I don't know if it's by or B, Bialoski. It's a memoir, it's called, but it's 51 poems, and each of the poems in the book is a poem that, to her, literally saved her life or helped her along at crucial moments in her life, and she's had a number of them, including the suicide of her sister, the death of her father, marriage, the first child, and she goes back and talks about what these poems meant. For instance, when she was in fourth grade, her father had died 2 years before, so that she had no family like all the other kids in the class had, and she felt out of it. She felt alone. She felt isolated. There's nobody like me. And the teacher one day, with great meaning, read The Road Not Taken.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And she said, it changed my life. I'm taking the road not taken, right? Even though that isn't what the poem is about. Then she goes on in each of these poems, and each of these poems do, each one of these 51 poems is a crucial moment in her life. But then not only does she say why this poem was important to me then, but how she has grown to love the poem and understand it and be enriched by it for the rest of her life, too. It is just a wonderful combination of memoir and poetry. Poetry will save your life. She deals with the death of her father, leaving home for the first time, her marriage, her sister's suicide, the birth of a child. Each poem gives her the first reaction to it. Each has a major theme: discovery, danger, selfhood, shame, wonder. It is full of poems that I just love. I mean, I've read a lot of these poems. Many I haven't read. But let me just read, since it's Poetry Month, I get to read a poem.
Wait a minute. I mean, there are some liberties one ought
well,
not be allowed.
I'm sorry. I can't write them, but I'm going to read them. Here's a poem. We talked about people being intimidated by poetry. Who could ever be intimidated by Emily Dickinson's I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Have you ever read that?
Yes.
I'm nobody, who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'll advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public like a frog. To tell one's name the livelong June. to an admiring bog.
Yeah, that's
you know,
true.
There are kids out there to whom that's a comforting poem.
My mother used to say, "Fools' names, like their faces, always seen in public places." And I thought, and after hearing that, I got on television. But that's, you know, it's that is interesting, a combination of memoir and poems. And you wonder what happened at a particular point in her life. Did she at that instant write something? Or was it contemplation of that led her to write a poem? That would be, I'd love to ask. I'd love to ask to see how the poem articulates with the sequence of events.
Right. Yeah, I don't know, but it's got to be something like that, right?
Uh-huh. You would think so. Do you have other poems there that you love?
Well, I have how many minutes do I have?
We've got about 3 minutes here. You got plenty of time.
Are you familiar with Musée des Beaux-Arts by W.H. Auden?
I read it and I'll tell you.
She's dealing with the death of her sister and the way in which the whole world goes on. You know, here's this tragedy that's hitting her personally, and who else cares? Nobody.
Yeah.
And Auden has captured that. It's about Bruegel's Icarus, the poem, the picture by Bruegel of Icarus falling into the sea while a plowman in the front is going the other way, hasn't even noticed the ship is going the other way.
I know that picture.
Well, yeah. Here's the poem. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course, anyhow in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on.
You know, I've often thought that when a good friend of mine died, the next week I thought, nobody seems to miss him. The world that we both inhabited just went on. It was gone. It's as if, you know, the waters had closed over him and he was gone. And I thought, boy,
I don't think there's a human that hasn't felt that.
Yeah. And you think, well, then what am I worried about? Because when I'm gone, I'm really gone. And that's true for all of us. That image of the water closing over your heads is a strong one for me. But at this point, I think it's about time for us to acknowledge the existence of the clock and bring our program to a close. We've been talking about poetry. We talked to a fine poet today, Lucas Street, and we'll do some more poetry next week. We hope you'll join us then for the next edition of Scribble.